to wrap up the final message on the feast before Fred gives his. This is the last great day, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time because we want to make sure that we have enough time for the main message. But I do want to wrap up as best I can what I spoke about yesterday and the day before. We're pretty much through, actually, with the criminal justice system. The ultimate, of course, is God pouring out his plagues as the end of his criminal justice effect. Now what I want to do is start in with the Land Sabbath and the Jubilee year. And I think you'll find it very, very interesting. We're going to start out in Leviticus. We spent a fair amount of time in Leviticus and Numbers, haven't we? Maybe we spent more time in Leviticus than we care to. But nevertheless, Leviticus chapter 25, verse 1. That's page 242 if you're looking. And the Lord spoke to Moses in Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you, then shall the land keep a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall sow your field 6 years, you shall prune your vineyard 6 years, and gather in the fruit of it. But in the seventh year shall be a Sabbath of rest to the land, a Sabbath for the Lord. You shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. You shall not reap that which grows of its own accord for your harvest, neither gather the grapes of your undressed wine or vine as a harvest. It is a year of rest to the land. Rather, the Sabbath yield of the land shall be food for you and for your servant, for your slave woman, for your hired servant, and for your stranger who stays within you, and for your livestock, and for the beast that is in your land, shall all the increase of it be food for you." Now, we left here at verse 7, but then we have to drop down to verse 9. Let's see here. We got to drop down a few verses because 19. Here we go. Because in between begins the Jubilee year. But verse 19, we continue with the land Sabbath. "And the land shall yield its fruits, and you shall eat your fill and dwell in it in safety. And if you shall say, what shall we eat the seventh year? Behold, we shall not sow nor gather in our increase. Then I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year, and it shall bring forth fruit for 3 years. And you shall sow the eighth year and eat of old fruit in storage until the ninth year. Until its fruits come in, you shall eat the old fruit." Now what God is telling us here is that just as we are to keep the Sabbath, his land is to keep the Sabbath. Because as we're going to see here in two different scriptures, and this is part of the preamble or part of our introduction to the Jubilee year, in verse 23, "The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine." See, God owns the land, and he wants his land to keep the Sabbath as well. And to show you how important that is, we're going to look at three other scriptures just very briefly. First, Leviticus 26, just one chapter over, verse 33. "And I will scatter you among the nations and will draw out a sword after you." This is if Israel does not obey God. "And your land shall be a desolation and your cities waste. Then shall the land enjoy its Sabbaths as long as it lies waste. And you are in your enemy's land. Then shall the land rest and enjoy its Sabbaths." As long as it lies waste, it shall rest because it did not rest in your Sabbaths. This is important to God, more than we realize. Now take a look at 2 Chronicles 36, verses 20-21. This is the last book of the Old Testament. And we're going to find something very similar to it. We're going into 2 Chronicles 36, page 956, if you're looking, beginning in verse 20. "And the ones who had escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of the desolation it kept the Sabbath to the full measure of 70 years." And now one quick reference a couple of books the other way, just before 1 Chronicles. This is just a statement in passing, talking about some of the reforms of Nehemiah. And we don't realize what a tremendous effort Ezra and Nehemiah went through to restore the government in ancient Judea after the Persian let them free. Nehemiah 10. Now this, by the way, is just a reference, but notice what it says. Nehemiah chapter 10 and verse 31. And if the people of the land bring goods or any food on the Sabbath to sell it, that we should not buy it from them on the Sabbath or on a holy day, and that we would forego the 7th year's produce. So here's Nehemiah talking about the land Sabbath. Now, the way in essence it worked would be this. You can just move back to Leviticus 25. I will read from it again in a few minutes. In the 6th year, God promised, I will give you a bumper crop. And that bumper crop was going to, in essence, last for 3 years. You would plant at the beginning of the 6th year, harvest the end of the 6th year, and the harvest would be so great that you would have enough food for the end of the 6th year, all the 7th, because remember now, you're not planting in the 7th year. Of course, something's going to grow on its own. I know in our home, in the back, we have 2 of the most productive, fruitful orange trees you have ever seen. They're Valencia oranges, and this year's crop we can see coming on. It is a bumper crop. Well, certain fruits, vegetables, plants are going to grow on their own. So the 7th year, you can eat those, but don't harvest them. No merchandising. You don't sell them. Then you begin to plant in the 8th year. But you're not going to bring in that harvest till the end of the 8th year. So you have the end of the 6th year, all the 7th, most of the 8th. So you've got 3 years. And, of course, you can start to eat the 8th year's produce at the beginning of the 9th year. So that's what God is telling us. And I gave the illustration, and I'll just briefly mention it because I don't want to take up too much time here. About 20, 30 years ago, there was in Israel today, the nation we call Israel, a religious group that were going to start a kibbutz, which is a farm, collective farm. Israel was loaded with farms like this in the 40s and the 50s and 60s. And it was a religious one. And their calendar, remember, every year was, they had the calendar. They all had the same years. No such thing as a different calendar year for different groups. And they had the same calendar going way back. And everybody knew when the 7th year was, when the 6th year was. And this kibbutz was being started in the 6th year. They didn't have any seed. Well, what are we going to do? So they went around to some non-religious kibbutzim. Do you have any food? Do you have any seed? Well, we have this musty old seed. We don't even know if it's any good. Well, they took it, and they planted it with the intention they were going to keep the land Sabbath. Now remember, God said, in the land, these were Jews, not sons of God, not converted, physical Israelites, in the land, and God promised them, if you do this in the land, I will bless you. Well, lo and behold, one of the biggest bumper crops in the history of the state of Israel. Experts from the University of Tel Aviv Agricultural Department came to try to scratch their heads and figure it out. Couldn't do it. Well, leave it to the Orthodox rabbis and the Jewish press to bring this out. They knew what had happened. Every religious Jew in Israel knew what had happened. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob blessed the land and gave it to them. So that covenant is in effect today, but it's in the land. Now, whether or not it would work for us here? Yes, it's the land of Manasseh. This is true. I don't know. Okay? I really don't know. But nevertheless, we know God gave them that land. Now, in terms of tithing, they tithed in the land. You know, when they were in Greece and Rome, they didn't tithe. It was unclean. It was impure. In fact, it was sacrilegious to tithe on produce grown in Greece, Athens, Corinth, Rome. In Babylon, yes, because there were so many Jews in Babylon, it was considered part of Israel. By the time of Jesus, you know, in the days of Philo of Alexandria, there were so many Jews in Egypt that it was permissible to tithe on the land in Egypt. But in the Ptolemies, in the early days, no, it wasn't, because there weren't that many Jews there. That's just a little aside. Okay. Now that we're through with the land Sabbath, but the idea is the Sabbath. God says, it's my land, not yours. I own it. I give it to you. And as Fred was talking to us about, you know, who really owns the universe, whether you have beneficial use of the land, he gives us beneficial use, but he's the ultimate owner of it. So understanding that, we're now going to go into the Jubilee year. And this is most interesting. There are three concepts to remember before we actually discuss it. One, all land belongs to God. We went over the scripture, Leviticus 25, 33, and you'll find the same thing in Psalms 24, verse 1. God says all the earth is his. Also, each family had a basic plot of land. It was administered under Joshua and then into the judges. And third, no taxes on the land. Today you own your home, you're going to pay property taxes. Tough. That's the way it is. Not so under God, because God owned the land. You don't have to pay taxes on what he owns. So there were no taxes. But the assumption was this, that God says, this is your land, you're going to live on it. You're not going to be uprooted from it. You are tied to that soil. And the Jubilee year was to make sure that nobody could rob you of your land indefinitely. That every 50 years, no matter what, back you would come to your land. That way, no big robber land barons. No individuals amassing huge amounts of land wealth. God's system made that impossible. But I thought, well, what if it could work here? Because the pioneers coming west, wasn't that similar? Yes, it was. But it couldn't work here. Because it wasn't set up that way from the beginning. How many of you recall the name Alexis de Tocqueville? Does anybody know? Good. Alexis de Tocqueville was a French aristocrat who, with a friend, came to the United States for about 9-10 months in the year 1832. And he wanted to study democracy in America. And he wrote a book called Democracy in America. Now, it wasn't for Americans. It was for Frenchmen, because he was from France. And he wanted to introduce American democracy to the French. Ostensibly, he came to study penitentiaries, prisons. He told the people in France, the government, we want to do this and report on it. And we'll do it at our own expense. Well, if you're doing it at your own expense, God bless you. Go. Do. And so they did. But they really wanted to discover what made democracy tick in America, because Alexis de Tocqueville realized that democracy, this representative form of government, where God was king and no man, was the way to the future, the way to prosperity. He firmly believed that. But I don't know if you know this. I didn't know it until I studied Alexis de Tocqueville. When he studied the prison systems, you ever heard of penitentiary? You know where that word comes from? What it really means? Penitence. Repentance. So the concept was that you would do penance in prison. You would become a penitent person. You would repent so that when you got out, you wouldn't do what you formerly did. Well, I'll leave it to you to decide how effective it really was, but at least this was the concept. But what he found was that people kept moving west. They had a plot of land here, and after a few years, they moved west. There was no plot of land for each family. And you notice that is wanderlust. And of course, God put it in them because he wanted this whole land settled from sea to shining sea. But as long as you didn't have a plot of land for the family, I realized, no, this could not work, because there was no family plot that way. He also discovered something else, which I did not realize. I know from being Jewish, having been reared in a Jewish home, that in Judaism, you're supposed to be a pious person. Now, pious person means you obey God. But how can you obey God if you don't know what God has said? Well, how do you know what God has said? Well, you have to be able to read. So male education was compulsory. I'm sorry, if you weren't a male, well, you females, maybe you did, maybe you didn't. A little male chauvinism here. But you could not perform the functions without being able to read and write, which put the Jews light years ahead of other Gentile neighbors throughout Europe. And something else, I don't know if you know this or not, I didn't until a few some years ago. You know, you go to a wine store, you go into a liquor store, and you see bottles of wine. They're different shapes, aren't they? Different sizes. Well, why? Well, my wife and I were up in San Francisco one time. We took a wine tour. And in one of the wineries, we had a lecture on wine. Now, what happens is that in the Middle Ages, people couldn't read. But in certain sections of France, you had certain wines. In England, you had certain wines. In Germany, you had certain wines. In Spain, you got maybe you had a Cabernet. Maybe it was a Pinot Noir. Maybe it was a Merlot. Whatever. Well, they put a wine in a certain shaped bottle. So when you saw the bottle, you knew which wine it was because you couldn't read the label. And this is what carried on into the United States, especially from Catholics. Not the Catholic people were dumb or stupid. They weren't. But they weren't taught to read and write. But now the Protestants broke away from that. And they said the scriptures only. Well, how could you know the scriptures unless you could read? So every male, and most of the females too, could read. And Alexis de Tocqueville was absolutely flabbergasted. Because wherever he went, farms, little ranches, the nearest neighbor would be 20 miles away. Go into that house as he did, and behold, there were at least three books. One of them was the Bible. And they could all read it. And they all did read it. So they were educated. Another one, believe it or not, was Shakespeare. Be surprised how many people in this country in the 1820s and 30s and 40s actually read Shakespeare. But they did. And he tried to figure out the strength of the country. What makes this country tick? He saw the farms. He said, yeah, but we got farms in France too. He saw the military. Yeah, strong military, but come on, the British Empire, but they've got strong military too. That doesn't do it. He looked at machinery, manufacturing. Well, we've got manufacturing in Europe too. And finally, he said, he went into the churches. He said, there he found it. It was a dynamism. This was the heyday of American Protestantism. This was Protestantism on the march. Not today. If he went into Protestant churches today, he wouldn't come away with the same observations. He said the American families were strong, solid. I don't think he'd come away with that same observation today. But back then, it was. And he said they didn't preach doctrine so much. He listened to sermon after sermon, not much in the way of doctrine, but morality, love of God, honesty, integrity. He said, America was a land of business. You recall the famous statement of Calvin Coolidge, president, America's business is business? That's what he said. But to have good business, you have to have honesty, you have to have trust, you have to have integrity. And that's what the Protestants taught. And that's what was needed for capitalism. Capitalism succeeded because people were honest. If you don't have honesty and trust, then it doesn't work. And that's why we're having our problems today. Honesty and trust and morality is going by the boards. Well, anyway, this was Alexis de Tocqueville, and he came away with these observations. And you know what his prediction was for the 20th century and beyond? He said the two great empires, he said, two greatest powers will be one, the United States, and two, Russia. And remember, this was the day when Britain was coming into its heyday. One, he said, will be based on oppression. The other will be based on liberty. Amazing observation of Alexis de Tocqueville. But what I'm pointing here is that you have to have a plot of land. And so without reading the whole thing, but you should read it at your leisure. Let me explain what was going on in this, in the Jubilee year. If you went and you became poor, or maybe your family was aged, or whatever it is, and you needed money, you couldn't upkeep your land, you could sell it to someone, and they would buy it from you. Now, how would you determine the price? Well, remember, you couldn't buy the land. You weren't buying the land, because the land was God's, and God said, I give it to your family. You couldn't take it away from that family. So you would figure out how many harvests are there till the next Jubilee year. Obviously, if you were in the fifth year and you had 45 years to go or so, you would pay a bigger price. If this were already the 40th year or so, when you had 5 or 10 years, you'd pay a smaller price. Now, at any time that you sold it, you could buy it back. At any time. So if you're going to buy someone's land, you got to think twice. Do I really want to buy the land? How much do I want to pay for it? And to realize I might have to give it up at any time. Now, of course, if it was bought back, then you had to figure out what the price would be. Well, wait a minute. I bought this land with 20 years to go to the land Sabbath, to the Jubilee year, and at the end of 10 years, he's buying it back from me. Well, now, wait a minute. I got to be compensated because I've already paid you for 20 years worth. So you would adjust the price up or down, depending on how many years there were left. But the concept was that you were tied to the soil. This was your inheritance. God didn't want you to lose that inheritance. We understand the stability of the system. No big booms or busts. You couldn't be forced into cities. You couldn't. God said, the land I give you. Now, on the other hand, if you were in the city, now this was a little different. Here you were in the city and you wanted to sell your land. Okay, you could sell your house and someone could buy it. You had 1 year in which to redeem that house. And if you could redeem it, and you could at any time, it went back to you. But if 1 year came and went, it was the new buyer. It was his in perpetuity. You lost the right to that house because there was a difference between your farmland, your home right there on the hearth, so to speak. That was the land. What you had in a walled city was not the land. It was just a house in which you might live for part of the time. And it was also a benefit to the one who bought it, because then the one who bought it could make improvements to it. And if you wanted to redeem that house, you would have to pay not just the price of the house that you sold it for. Well, wait a minute. He made improvements to it. Well, what was the value? Excuse me. What was the value of those improvements? So you had to add that. Therefore, a person who bought that house realized that, number one, if the former owner did redeem it, he could get paid fully for all his efforts. But if he couldn't redeem it, it would be his. So that gave him incentive to put improvements in the house. So then the cities were built up properly. But if you bought someone's farmland, well, you had to be careful. Because no matter what, you're going to lose that land. You weren't buying the land. You were simply buying the harvest. Whereas a house in a walled city, you were buying the house. Now, this did not include the Levites' land. You'll find out that you could never take away the land of the Levites. God forbade it because they had no inheritance. There was no section, here's Judea, here is Naphtali, here is Reuben, here is Ephraim, over there is Manasseh. It was their land. But Levites had none. Therefore, their cities were inviolate. You could not take away their cities no matter what. And in this Jubilee year, the end of it, everybody went back to his land. So you'd have prosperity, and you wouldn't have poverty. Yes, people could be poor, but they could always come back to their land. They could always have a fresh start. And it was an amazing system. It was a marvelous system. And I wish we could do it today, but we can't. We're in a totally Babylonian system. We're in a greedy system. We're in a system where malice runs and greed, or as it has been said, vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed. Well, even though you might have greed in the old days, the system God set up would nullify that. I don't care how greedy you were, you had to get back the land in the Jubilee year. Now, one thing, this is a small thing, but you should know it. We talked about trumpets and the shofar. The Jubilee year in Leviticus 25 and verse 9. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, in the Day of Atonement. The trumpet shall sound throughout all your land. Now this indeed is the shofar. But remember, you didn't have only the shofar. When it came to the religious procedures at the temple, the shofar was not blown. Turn over with me to Numbers chapter 10. Now, English translations, including the one we have here, doesn't always make that clear. It's pretty tough because you can translate a trumpet, and that's true. But notice what it says in Numbers chapter 10. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, make two trumpets of silver. This is not shofar. This is chatzitzrot. It's kind of tough to pronounce in the Hebrew. But it's trumpets of kesef. And kesef means money. But back in those days, money was silver. That's why we know it says trumpets of silver. I don't know how you could build a trumpet of dollar bills. You know, it wouldn't work. So, but the word today, Hebrew, the word for money is kesef. And silver was money. So that's why we translated silver. But the word is kesef. And you read throughout that when the priests would blow the trumpets in the religious ceremonies at the temple, they weren't blowing the shofar. They were blowing the silver trumpets. And only the priest could blow the trumpets. Now, priests could also blow the shofar too, but it was primarily their function to blow the trumpets. When you read throughout the Old Testament, and Joab blew the horn, that was always the shofar. When you read in Exodus 19, and the trumpet sounded long, loud, shofar. Always shofar. But with religious rites and the priest, it was the silver trumpets. And where you said, blow the horn in Zion, or blow the horn here, you got to be careful. Are you talking about a national thing? Are you talking about a priestly city? When it's a priestly city, it may say horn or trumpet, but it's going to be the silver trumpet because it's a priestly city. So the silver trumpets are always connected with the priests. The shofar is connected nationally, time of war, time of gathering the people. And that is as far as I'm going to go in delving into the Jubilee year. You should read it. The rest talks about if you took a slave in, if your Hebrew brother be poor and waxen, not a home, but it's here in Leviticus 25. You take him in, he goes out in the Jubilee year, and you give him liberally. He's not your slave. So you couldn't have perpetual slaves. Now, other nations, yes. If you had the quote-unquote the Gentiles, the Goyim, as it's called in Hebrew, then God permitted you to have slaves indefinitely. And you also want to compare Leviticus 25 with Numbers 21, and what happens when you take in a Hebrew manservant. Don't need to turn to it now, but compare the two, and it's almost identical. The principle is there. Now, one thing I want to leave you with is simply a little of what I call, if I bring it up with me here, I don't know if I did, and if I didn't, what I will do, I will go back, and I will get my one piece of paper, because I wrote some things down that I think you'll find interesting. This is not all important. This is not, you know, hey, if you don't know this, forget it. You've lost out of salvation. No. But there is a phrase in the Old Testament that he said to himself. He thought within himself. He said to his heart. This type of phrase. Well, there are two different Hebrew prepositions that are used. One is b, like the bet, the b, which means in, with, or by. This is a person thinking within himself. This is the self. You know, what did Jeremiah say? Oh, Lord, I know that the way of a man is not within him. Okay, this is within. The other one is le, or al, meaning upon or to. In that sense, he's speaking to himself. He's directing himself. And you will find every time you have the b, bad decision. Bad. Every time it has the al or the le, good decision. Good decision. And the Israeli airline is El Al, which means up to. This is what I call Watigwa, okay? Y'all know what Watigwa stands for? Worthless information, too good to throw away, okay? So this we will call Watigwa. When you go to Israel, when you went to the Lord, what did you do? You went up to Jerusalem. You didn't go down. You went up to, let us go up to the house of the Lord. So when you're going to fly to Israel today, God's country, well, it's not really God's country today. It will be. Not yet. But when you fly to Israel, you're flying to God's country. You're flying to God's holy land. So, where are you going? You're going up. So, El Al means up to God's country. That's why they named it El Al. It's a worthless information, too good to throw away. But now, let's take a look at just three or four scriptures, and then we will wrap this up, and we'll be ready for the rest of the service. Let's look at a couple of illustrations. A few of them. Genesis 8, verse 21. Now, this is God speaking to himself. Genesis 8, 21. This is right after the flood. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor. And the Lord said, in his heart. Now, in is a correct translation. But you have to understand, is this b with in, or is this al or la? To. It is la. It is al. God is speaking to himself, saying, I will not do this again. Good decision. Very, because God always makes good decisions. He never makes a bad decision. But the form is to. Now let's look at another one. Let us look at Genesis 27, verse 41. Now, I'll let you come to the conclusion as to what, which word or which preposition this is. Genesis 27, 41. All right, this is where Jacob, the supplanter, he's taken away the birthright. Jacob was a conniver. We know that. And Esau was furious. And look at 41. And Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said in his heart. Now, what do you think? Is this speaking to himself, giving himself direction in a positive way? Or is this the vanity, the jealousy, the lust from within? Buh. You bet. It is buh. Always bad decision. Wrong thinking. Let's just look at a couple more. We won't have. Psalm 14:1. This is one that I'm sure we have all read and all commented upon many times. Psalm 14. 14:1. The fool has said in his heart. You bet. Buh. Bad decision. Bad conclusion. And you will find throughout the Old Testament, when it says, he said within himself, he thought to himself, he thought within him. Now, let me see if I can get you the ultimate one, in a sense, an ultimate one. Okay, we're going to go now to the book of Esther. And I will wrap it up with this Esther. We could go on with several of them. In this case, the book of Esther. And we're going to be going to page 846, if you're looking in your faithful version here. This is the account when the king of Persia couldn't sleep, and they read him in the book of the law there about the bodyguards who were going to assassinate him and what Mordecai did, and he's trying to figure out how to honor him, and in comes the wicked Haman. Haman, the evil one. And so in verse 6, so Haman came in, and the king said to him, what shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman thought in his heart. All right, good decision, bad decision, good person, bad person. You know without even going to the Hebrew what it is, buh, within him. You know it is. So when you read throughout, I don't want to take up any more time. Throughout Genesis, the Chronicles, anybody, king, a peasant, a false prophet, he said within himself, he said to himself, he thought to himself, if it's a good decision, I have never seen it fail. It's always le or al, because this is the person in his mind serving God, directing himself. But the buh comes from within, the human nature. And Jeremiah said, oh Lord, I know the way of man is not within himself. Or How about Jeremiah 17:9? We all know that. The heart's deceitfully wicked. He's thinking within his own heart, devoid of God's Spirit. It's going to be bad decision. Well, there are other things I could say, but it's been my pleasure to speak to you these last 3 days. And while I don't know how much great spiritual truth I have been able to impart to you, I hope from a technical point of view, from the point of view of God's criminal system, justice system, from his tithing system, his economic system, at least you have a better feel for the system that God established in ancient Israel. And all we can do is speculate how it is going to be in the world tomorrow. We have a glimpse from what he did. But just exactly how it's going to be, we'll just have to wait. And Jesus of Nazareth, our elder brother, will tell us. And who knows? If we learn enough and grow enough, he might just say to some of us, good, you understand this. You go apply this. You go administer this over here. Wow. Wouldn't that be great?